David Robertson, welcome to Sunday Night at the TSO.
Oh, thank you so much. It's nice to be here.
We're very excited about your imminent arrival in Toronto. And as you are a first-time guest at Sunday Night at the TSO, I have a few quick get-to-know-you questions.
Excellent. Okay.
Here's a tough one. I know it's always hard for musicians. Do you have a favorite composer?
I will quote my wife on this. I don't have a favorite composer, but if I did, it would be Brahms.
Okay, nice choice. Coffee or tea?
Coffee.
Favorite city that you've performed in?
Oh, boy, I'm going to make a lot of people angry that way. But I do love Sydney.
Oh, yeah. Red or white wine?
I'm ecumenical, both.
Now, I'm wondering, is there one symphony or composer that you wish more orchestras would play?
That's a tough one. I enjoyed doing the Kalinikov First Symphony. He was a poor Russian man who came in the shadow of Tchaikovsky, and I think his musical gifts were amazing in the two symphonies, but it's very hard to convince people to play them because he's not well known.
Now, you were the Grammy winner for Best Opera Recording for Porgy and Bess. I just wanted to talk a little bit about that because that was quite a big deal, that revival, I remember, at the Met a few years ago. How was that for you? Talk about that.
Well, it was very nice because we actually were the first performance to use the critical edition that was brought out. And that had all of the information about the score with which one could then make the decisions, both the orchestration and then also with regard to various cuts that had been done before. And I felt gratified in, it's a hard piece to play without any cuts. And in fact, the misnomer comes from the fact that Gershwin at the time published the complete piano score so that it would be ready for rehearsals. And he knew afterwards that there would be cuts. And so he was party to some of them. And then there are other cuts that have been made since that I think would have him shifting his in his seat in heaven. But the production that we did managed to keep a great deal of the composed symmetry that he had put into the work. And so I think that that sort of arch form that exists in the piece comes through very beautifully in Jim Robinson's production and in the recording.
Now, as you're about to arrive in Toronto, we're wondering, what are you most looking forward to as you make your TSO conducting debut?
Oh, getting to know the orchestra mainly. I think that's the biggest thing. I mean, it's the long-awaited debut because I was first slated to conduct the orchestra in December of 1999. So quarter century later is just fine. So it's really wonderful that it worked out this way. And, you know, I spoke with Michael Tilson Thomas. We had a delightful conversation because he's such a miracle of a person. And I spoke to his partner, Joshua, who said that he was very pleased, that Michael was very pleased that I was able to take over this concert. So I'm really looking forward to the program and to getting to know the orchestra.
Have you worked with any TSO musicians before?
I think I have, actually, in Aspen and various other places. So I'm looking forward to seeing them. And, you know, of course, it's an orchestra that I first got to know when Andrew Davis was the conductor of them, because I shadowed Sir Andrew a great deal in London and in Paris and various different places. And, you know, he always spoke highly of the orchestra. And so I'm really excited to be there.
Well, it's wonderful to at last make that, you know, one-to-one connection. Emily D'Angelo is the soloist for this program. Have you worked with her before?
No, I haven't, but I'm very pleased that that ended up working out because she's really a remarkable person from all that I can gather. And so I can't wait to do these Berg songs with her.
It's interesting that these songs are the sort of opening act, in a way, for Mahler Symphony No. 5, which is the huge work on the program. But they're written in the same decade, initially. Is there something that you find that these two works share?
Well, they share very much the same kind of air that's being, the French would say l'air du temps, you know, the sort of spirit of the age, in a sense, this kind of slightly hothouse atmosphere before things kind of came apart in the First World War. The interesting thing is that Mahler is using his orchestrations quite often to create chamber music like moments with huge numbers of players. So if you think of the opening of the last movement of the Fifth Symphony, you know, it almost sounds like it's going to be played by a woodwind quintet, but there's an entire orchestra sitting on the stage, and then he uses the full orchestra indeed. But there are moments where there are just a couple of instruments who make very poignant statements throughout the piece. And Berg is doing the same, where his orchestration from one song to the next changes every time. And this is very much in the way that, you know, Berg's thinking was, this is as much a structural as an expressive device. And you see the same kinds of ideas of how can I use musical material both for its expressive local purpose in the Mahler, but also Mahler using it as part of a larger structural narrative that he tells over the course of the symphony. So I think the two works really complement each other very well. Neither does what the other one is trying to do, which is also a good way of approaching the things.
Can you describe in a nutshell what those things are?
They're going into, I think, really intimate sort of feelings. So the, you know, feelings of seeing something in nature, whether that's a bird that's singing, and then feeling as though, although in a sense that there's an inarticulateness to your relationship with the bird, there's nonetheless the feeling that that bird has perfectly understood what it is that you are trying to express to your beloved, or your feeling that comes from being out in nature. And you know, the same thing in the Mahler, where the fabulous way in which what are clearly very intimate thoughts of love and attraction in the fourth movement are suddenly transformed into something that's light and playful and, you know, done in the real world in the last movement. And I think it's this sort of combination of things that make both pieces feel as though they're really speaking to us in intense terms, even when the tones in which this intensity comes are hushed and quiet.
Focusing on the Mahler 5 now, it is a work that seems to really encapsulate, I think, or is very kind of an iconic representation of Mahler, although it's, you know, not the biggest, longest of his symphonies. But what did you think it is about this particular piece that is so compelling?
You know, he's clearly channeling the famous fifth, right? Beethoven's, which has the trajectory from dark, stormy times to light and wonder at the end. And he's finding his own way to do this. We're seeing this kind of awareness of the ephemeral nature of human experience and the shadow of mortality that hangs over everything. And yet, finding a purpose and a way forward within that is very much part of the trajectory of the first two movements. And then this third scherzo seems almost to be mocking any of this, done in a very sort of peasant kind of dance in the Ländler, and then the more refined, almost waltz-like middle section. But these calls of things from far away, the past or from distance, and then a very quiet and, I've already said, intimate, but so intimate, that fourth movement, that it almost feels that it may not actually be expressed outside of one's head and one's heart to anyone else. You know, to me, it might be the sort of thoughts that you would have when your beloved is there sleeping soundly next to you. And so you can't say things loud because you don't wish to wake them. And yet the emotions are every bit as strong and passionate and arduous as they are when one's awake. And then the last movement manages to find a way to bring all of this together in what to me always feels like a very satisfactory conclusion of all of the tensions that he's built up in the piece of various different kinds.
It's quite a big program that you're leading, and on relatively short notice. I'm wondering, how do you prepare for this?
You know, I had someone ask me about something like that. I bought my first score of the Mahler 48 years ago. So I've known it for rather a long time and have been studying it for a long time. And I hope that I, you know, am getting better with it and figuring out more things with it. But, you know, these things, if you're lucky, they are a lifetime sort of engagement. And I was one of those strange kids growing up in Southern California, the way that it happens sometimes with teenagers, where I could actually sing the entire first and second act of Berg's Lulu pretty much by heart, and would do so to anyone who happened to be around, which was a great way to clear a room. So that my connection with Berg is sort of right at the start of what I would think of as the beginnings of my musical maturity. So when this program came about, I was delighted that both of these works are in my repertoire. They're ones that I love deeply. And so, you know, we could take the program as is.
I'm interested in your work with the Ensemble Intercontemporain and working also with Pierre Boulez, who, you know, a giant in so many ways, mm-hmm. and definitely the most mesmerizing conductor I have ever watched. I'm wondering, let's see, I have a twofold question. I guess I'm curious a bit about some insights into him, and then I'll follow that up with something else.
Well, it's interesting. I first, you know, went to Pierre and watched his rehearsals and concerts when I was a student in London in the late 70s. While he was no longer music director of the BBC Symphony Orchestra, he was still guesting and visiting them on a fairly regular basis. So there were a number of works that, you know, I have to pinch myself now to realize that the first time I got to hear Die Jakobsleiter was in a concert sitting pretty close to the chorus in Royal Festival Hall in London with Pierre conducting. And, you know, many other works like that, where I was able to both, you know, go in and watch his rehearsals with the Berg Three Pieces for Orchestra, for example. What was fascinating was that even though, you know, he didn't know me from Adam, when he would come in and he saw me there sitting either with the scores or just sitting and listening, he was always very polite and nice and said, "Oh, hello, good morning." Right? And it never went beyond that. You know, he has this supposed reputation as being formidable. You know, when he arrived in New York, one of the headlines was "The Iceman Cometh," right? And not a bit the sort of sense of humor and the sense of passion and all of this, that was very clear. At the same time, you know, he was extremely serious about doing music and trying to get the music done at the very highest quality. He saw me conducting a piece, and I had no idea that he was in that concert at Radio France. And one part of the piece had the orchestra going in two different time signatures. So I had to do a Pierre Boulez imitation, and I put my baton down, and I had my hands in his sort of copyrighted fashion, making these gestures and keeping everyone together. And then imagine my chagrin when he came into my dressing room after the concert and introduced himself. And I wanted to say, you know, I know who you are. From that was the beginning of a really wonderful friendship where we got to discuss a great deal of music and spend a lot of time. And I actually had the distinct pleasure of convincing him to do a couple of pieces with the ensemble that he had not thought to do himself. And they were, of course, naturally fantastically successful.
You've dwelled a lot in contemporary music, and I'm curious if you have a perspective on what that experience or how that experience informs or vivifies the way you do older repertoire, such as Mahler.
That's really the essential point. Once you've worked with living composers, you cannot look at composers who are no longer living as though they never lived. And so I am just as passionate about, you know, why Schubert might have done something and whether or not I am allowed to change it as I would be when working with a composer who could come up to the podium and say, "No, that's wrong. I wrote it this way and that's how I want it." This is very helpful because it allows you to really remember that everyone who wrote a piece of music was at some point a living, breathing human being. And he or she had very deep and strong ideas about why they went to all of the trouble to write a score down, to fix the musical ideas the way that they did. So that if someone writes a quarter note, and this is a person who later on writes something that is similar with a dotted eighth note, then you need to pay attention to that. I had an experience with Messiaen, which was really sort of a watershed moment for me. It happened to be in Jerusalem with the Jerusalem Symphony Orchestra. I adored and loved Messiaen, but this is the first time I was performing his works with him present. And I had to do they changed one of the pieces at the very last minute, and I got the score with quite short notice and learned it. And there was one tempo that I thought, this is wrong. It can't be right. It must be a misprint in the score. And then I heard the one recording that existed, and sure enough, they took the tempo that I thought it should be at. And so I said, yes, it's a misprint. French scores always have misprints in them. It's not a problem. And then we got to the rehearsal, and I did it at this tempo. And Messiaen came up and said, no, c'est trop vite. And then he sang it the way that he wanted it. And suddenly, the bowings made sense. The sound made sense. And I can remember being on the podium and thinking, wait, but that's like nothing I've ever heard before. And then the scales, just like Saul of Tarsus, who beheld the way, they fell from my eyes. And I went, oh my God, we ask composers to come up with sounds that we have never heard before and have not imagined before. So why do we then try to take them and make them like sounds that we are familiar with? And so, to some extent, this means that when I'm doing Beethoven or Mozart or Haydn or Bach, and something doesn't really make sense, right? Something's incongruous or seems strange. Rather than going into their garden and saying, oh, this plant doesn't belong here, we should dig it up and put it over there, I think really long and hard about why I would change that. And frequently, it has led me to think, if there's something that I don't understand in why a piece of music is the way it is, or why a composer has written a certain thing, then I keep thinking until I do understand it, and it does make sense. Because that is what I would need to do if I were working with Berio or Ligeti or Boulez or any other composer that is alive today. They would want that kind of detail. And I think that's the kind of detail that Beethoven would want, and certainly that Schumann would want. Before you say my orchestration is bad, maybe you try and do my orchestration the way that I've actually put it down, and don't try and play it like something else. You know, when I was growing up, Sibelius was very hard to play. And the main reason Sibelius was hard to play was that at the time, everyone thought of it as poorly orchestrated Wagner. And in the time between, there has been enough sort of, the Finns have really gone out in the world with incredibly talented conductors and taught the world that, no, Sibelius wants this. It's really a remarkable sound, isn't it? And people have gotten used to the fact that these things sound the way they do. And so we don't try to morph it into some other kind of music where it feels as though it's inadequate. We play it for what it has. And then we realize that this is a very specific kind of beauty and a unique and individual one associated with just that person's imagination. And so this is kind of the approach that I take to every composer. No two composers sound alike.
Well, David Robertson, we are very much looking forward to your arrival in Toronto at long last, 24 yes. years later.
Yes.
And have a wonderful, wonderful week with the TSO.
Thank you so much. Looking forward.